they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers. Clearing the Fog is a project of PopularResistance.org. You can subscribe to it on Apple, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also find Clearing the Fog at PopularResistance.org. And while you're there, you can subscribe to the free Daily Digest. Each morning, you'll receive an email that has summaries of the articles posted the day before. This is a great way to keep up with movement news and analysis. So this week, I spoke with Beth Gelia. Beth is an anthropologist and a documentarian who focuses on urban political economy, land politics, and tech futurist territorial movements. And I spoke to her after her recent article in Truthout called U.S. Attacks in Venezuela, Greenland, Lay Groundwork for Billionaire Fiefdoms. And what Beth was talking about is these privatized economic, especially economic free zones. The first ones, I think, started in Honduras, and that's where Beth began studying them more than a decade ago. But they exist across the United States and around the world. And this is kind of part of this movement, this libertarian free market deregulation movement, where very wealthy people are trying to create these zones that can make their own rules, have their own police, and operate outside of the governments in the places where they exist. And this is something that the Trump administration is very supportive of and now is pushing this what's called a network state movement, which is basically these crowdsourced cryptocurrency entities that then seek land where they can create these private zones, and then they can use them to profit from. And what's concerning is that now they're also trying to tie them into militaries, and they want to create their own private, deregulated kind of a nation state. And this is where Beth talks about the possibility of Greenland becoming that place. If you don't know much about this, the ones in the Honduras are called ZEDES. They're economic and development and employment zones. And they were actually ruled unconstitutional by the country. There are a couple of organizations that are pushing these. One is called the Free Cities Foundation. It's led by a German economist named Titus Gebel. And then in the United States, we have one called Praxis. And Praxis wants to create, you know, the first Praxian nation. And I think they have around, when last I checked their website, more than 170,000 people who have signed up to be citizens in their digital nation. And Beth talks about a project that Praxis is proposing to build in California, close to the Vandenberg Space Force Base, which is around Santa Barbara. And they want to create this kind of private zone city. They're going to, you know, pass it off as this beachside industrial zone and create all this infrastructure, and then partner with the base to develop and fast track the development of weapons, drones, space infrastructure, and other types of technology, and then use the military base to test that technology. So they're touting this as some real great advancement for the U.S. military. And to me, that's just a very scary thing. And Beth and I talk about that. What's interesting is when I was reading to prepare for this interview, The Canary, which is a British publication, independent outlet, has covered the rise of these different kinds of zones in the United Kingdom following the Brexit. So now that the United Kingdom has left the European Union, it is no longer bound by those laws. And so they have a variety of different special economic zones that are being developed there. And basically what's common to all of them is that they carve out this land area. They make their own rules and organizations for that. The way they structure them, it's very hard to trace who's in charge, who's responsible for them. And they have a way of doing this so that they can buy the land with debt and then use the profits they make from the land to pay off that debt, as well as generating a profit for themselves. So this is kind of a foreboding type of future. And Beth also discusses how the Trump administration's Board of Peace in Gaza can be used as a way to advance these private entities throughout the world. So this is something I think is not being talked about enough. And it's something that could have a significant impact on the world going forward. So I hope that folks will check these out, look for these special economic zones, and find out if there's one in your region or what's being proposed in your region. But before we get to that interview with Beth, I do want to talk about some things that are in the news. And as I did last week, I'm going to begin with the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran that became a hot war on February 28th when the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran and murdered the Ayatollah Khamenei. And this is really quickly becoming a regional war that many people are calling the beginning of World War III, partly because this war on Iran is having global implications. And because Iran made it clear that if the United States attacks, then U.S. assets in the region will be considered targets. Of course, the Zionist state will be considered a target. And then any countries that are assisting the Zionist state and the United States in attacking Iran will be considered targets as well. And already, after the United Kingdom announced that they were going to be providing support for the attacks, Iran bombed their base in Cyprus. I think France has also said that they would be providing support to the U.S. and Israel. As I'll talk about in a little bit, Spain has declined to do that. And some other European nations have called out this war for the illegal action that it is. There's a lot of misinformation in the media about Iran, about the war. It's not about nuclear weapons. Under the Ayatollah Khamenei, who was murdered, he had a very strong stance against nuclear weapons. It's really about, and the Trump administration and Netanyahu have been very clear about this, it's about destabilizing Iran and regime change in the country. In fact, I think President Trump said he wants to pick the next leader of Iran. That's not going to happen. And I think what the U.S. and Israel are going to do is going to backfire in a huge way. Instead of destabilizing Iran so far, what they're doing is uniting Iran against the U.S. and Israel. And with the selection of the Ayatollah Khamenei's son, Sayed Mujtaba Hosseini Khamenei, as the new supreme leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Khamenei was chosen by the 88-member Assembly of Experts, which is how the governance system in Iran is set up, that they choose the supreme leader. Iran also has elections. They have a president, they have a parliament, and members of that who are elected. And they have this supreme council, and the supreme leader is the head of that. And the Ayatollah's son, Sayed Mujtaba Hosseini Khamenei, has worked for the Supreme Council. He has strong ties to the Iranian military, and the public came out in Iran in wide support for him after he was announced as the next supreme leader of Iran. So the revolution in Iran is continuing to stay strong despite the assault, and so far the U.S. and Israel have not succeeded in causing destabilization of the country, although they're causing tremendous damage to Iran and targeting citizens. As we know, the very first attack, which now it turns out was done by the United States using a Tomahawk missile, was on the school, the elementary school in southern Iran, that killed, I think reports I've seen are 185 people. More than 100 of those were the students, were children between the ages of 8 and 12. Iran has had said that if the U.S. attacked, it would attack U.S. assets, and it has done so. It has attacked satellite sites, military bases, U.S. embassies have been hit, and the United States is losing billions of dollars a day in just the first 100 hours of this attack. The United States costs were around $4 billion. This was according to the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Iran has knocked out THAAD systems and the early warning radar systems. One of those radar systems alone was worth $1.1 billion. And the Center for Strategic and International Studies, in their report on the cost of this war, wrote that there's a considerable lack of transparency around this particular war. They said previously, when the United States launched attacks in West Asia, there were daily briefings that, or what they call daily strike updates, that recorded who, you know, what was struck, what weapons were used. But this time there's a lot of secrecy around this. And of course, with the amount of money that's being spent, I'm sure that the U.S. government doesn't want folks to know too much about that. The United States is saying that so far 8 U.S. military members have been killed and 18 have been injured. Reports from Iran say that there were 21 soldiers, U.S. soldiers, killed in the attack on the Fifth Fleet in Bahrain, and around 200 U.S. soldiers killed in the attack on the Al-Dafra airbase in Iraq. Also, there were attacks on hotels where U.S. military members were staying as they were evacuated from the bases. So I think we're not getting good information on the number of casualties or the number of U.S. military members that have been killed so far. The State Department from the United States has told U.S. citizens to leave West Asia, but the government and the embassies are not providing assistance for people to do that. A lot of the airspace has been shut down in that region. Airports have been bombed as well. We do know that the largest U.S. Department of Defense hospital, which is in Germany, it's at the Ramstein Air Force Base. And that hospital recently reported that it is pausing its labor and delivery services. And we know that this hospital's basic role is to be, they specialize in critical combat care. So we don't have reports on how many U.S. military members are going there, but it is concerning that they're shutting down their maternity services. Either they have a load already of soldiers, or they're expecting a load of soldiers to be coming in who need treatment. There's also a lot of secrecy around both the deaths in the Zionist state and the damage that's being done there. Israel is forbidding people to post information about what structures have been attacked and those types of things. So we're only getting some leaks from folks that are getting that information out. The Zionist state is expanding this war as well. They're seeing this as an opportunity to try to create what they're calling Greater Israel. And this is their ambition, to have a state that extends from Egypt right up to the border of Iran. So it would include parts of Egypt, all of Lebanon, all of Jordan, all of Syria, and parts of Saudi Arabia and Iraq. And this is a crusade for the Zionist state to do this. And so they have been attacking Lebanon as well. Hezbollah is there in Lebanon, and they are attacking back. They have killed some IDF troops, and they've also been bombing the state of Israel. So this conflict is already including Cyprus, Lebanon, Israel, Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia. Yemen says that they're in a state of war and that they are ready to escalate depending on what happens. They said, quote, "We consider standing with Iran as a religious and national duty because it is on the front line confronting a project that targets the entire region, whether under the banner of Greater Israel or New Middle East." So they've been, you know, controlling the Red Sea, and they are ready to join in, as well as we have seen fighters from Iraq and Syria attacking the U.S. and Israel as well, attacking U.S. bases. Now, what's interesting is there's a Saudi journalist who's reporting that some of the attacks on the Gulf states are not coming from Iran, but have actually been launched either by the state of Israel itself or by its agents that are embedded in Iran. And the thinking is that the Zionist state is doing this because it's trying to provoke Gulf states to join it in the war on Iran. This whole conflict is causing a lot of turmoil for the Gulf states. Some of them have expressed concerns that the United States will, you know, stir things up and then declare that its objectives have been met and leave them without supporting them. Iran has made it very clear that they are going to continue this fight until they have gotten the United States out of West Asia and they have guarantees that they will not be attacked again by the U.S. and Israel. Even leading up to this attack on Iran, the former prime minister of Qatar had already been calling for states like Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Pakistan to join together in a strategic defense alliance. And many Gulf countries are reconsidering whether it is beneficial for them to be allied with the United States and to host U.S. military infrastructure. Now, I mentioned Spain is saying that the United States cannot use its bases in the war. The Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, has banned the U.S. from using the bases there that they share with Spain. He said Spain will not be complicit in something that is bad for the world and that is also contrary to our values and interests, simply out of fear of reprisals from someone, because, of course, the Trump administration threatened Spain over that and then said, hey, if you won't let us use the bases, we'll do it anyway. You know, try and stop us. That's the hubris of the United States. The U.S. attacks in Iran, and people are comparing this to how Israel has operated in its attacks on Palestinians. Just in the beginning of this, you know, it's only, 9 days into it, as I record this, the United States has attacked 20 schools in Iran, as well as many hospitals and residential areas. More than 1,200 Iranians have been killed, and 30% of those are children. This, you know, all of this, again, like we saw or have seen and continue to see in Palestine, goes against the typical standards of how wars are operated. But we know that the war secretary, Pete Hegseth, has already been bragging that the United States will not be bound by rules of engagement. On March 6th, the U.S. State Department bypassed Congress and approved the sale of 1,000-pound bombs to the state of Israel. They did this by declaring this an emergency due to the U.S.-Israel war on Iran, something that has not been approved by Congress. So it is an illegal war. This is $151.8 million worth of weapons, as well as logistic and technical support that will be provided to the state of Israel. These are bombs that are manufactured by Repkon USA, R-E-P-K-O-N, Repkon USA. And as I said, this was done outside of the way that things are normally conducted with congressional review. So if you have a RepCon company, corporation, headquarters, whatever near you, that would be a good target to protest them. As I said, this is becoming a global conflict and having global implications. And one of those is the fact that Iran, as they threatened, closed the Strait of Hormuz. Now, this is where 20% of the world's oil passes. And this has caused oil prices to rise very quickly. And some countries that depend on shipping their oil through that strait have already said that they're going to stop producing gas and oil. They don't have the ability to store it. So this will have global impacts on that, as well as what's not being talked about is the impact on the food supply, because many of the inputs for agriculture in the world also pass through the Strait of Hormuz. And I read today that Iran is also considering, if things continue, to close the Bab el-Mandab Strait as well. Now, what's heartening is that many military members in the United States are already taking steps to resist being part of this illegal war. And, oh, I also wanted to mention that there have been, in the first, I think, 48 hours of this attack on Iran, there have been more than 110 official complaints lodged by members of the military from more than 40 units across more than 30 military installations, because their commanders are portraying this war using what they call crusade-style rhetoric. Basically, they report that senior officers are calling the war on Iran part of God's divine plan. They claim that President Trump was, quote, anointed by Jesus, unquote, to spark Armageddon. Let's see, they say President Trump has been anointed by Jesus to light the signal fire in Iran to cause Armageddon and mark his return to Earth. In addition to this, President Trump has a personal spiritual advisor, Paula White Kane, who runs the White House Faith Office. And she's been organizing these events where people come to lay their hands on Trump as this holy Messiah. So all of this has a very strange bent to it. Andy Worthington reports that Christian Zionists believe that the founding of the State of Israel in 1948 is a critical component of biblical prophecies in the Old Testament, which indicate that the reestablishment of Jewish sovereignty in Palestine and the wider Levant region is a prerequisite for the second coming of Jesus Christ. So this is causing many in the military to pause, as well as those who work at GI hotlines to help members of the military if they're wondering what their options are. They don't want to go and fight in this war. Apparently, they're getting inundated with calls. They say the phones are ringing off the hook, and that troops and their families are telling them that troops are already being sent to the region, and that there may be a ground invasion by the United States of Iran. Now, Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report has an excellent article talking about how in the United States, because of all of this misinformation about Iran and this whole narrative of women being oppressed there, that liberals in the United States are supporting this war on Iran. And she reminds us that according to a United Nations report, Iranian women make up more than half of all university students. In fact, when I was in Tehran, they said that 70% of their PhD students were women. Literacy rates for women have more than doubled since the 1979 revolution. And there's, you know, if you go to Iran, yes, they do have a number of laws related to being an Islamic state. But what's interesting is that it's not a repressive society. I didn't feel like it was repressive at all when I was there. You would see women, some were in a full chador, covered head to toe. Others just wore a small scarf on their head. Sometimes you would see people without one. it was not, you know, it was not a big deal there. But you have kind of people in the United States that are being swayed by this misinformation and believing that this conflict is about freeing Iranian women. What the Iranian woman I spoke to told me when I was there is that the people from the West should not be imposing their values on Iranian people. This is an old culture. It's a very intelligent population, and they can make their own decisions about how they want to run their country. They don't need some sort of savior. Of course, we know it's the United States has never been a savior for another country. No country has been better off because the United States attacked it. One concern that is that I have, a big concern, is the risk of a nuclear war, because Israel has nuclear weapons and has never joined treaties. And the Israelis believe that this is a war that's in service of God. So I think we need to be very concerned about the possible use of a nuclear weapon. Also, there are people in Washington and the Pentagon who believe that there can be what they call tactical nuclear strikes, but any launch of nuclear weapons could trigger a series of devastating events. So let's see, as far as trying to stop this war, there have been all kinds of protests going on. The UN Security Council held a meeting on February 28th. Unfortunately, they did not pass a resolution addressing this, but Marjorie Cohn, who's a lawyer, reminds us that the United Nations General Assembly can convene under a Uniting for Peace, and they can recommend that member states impose arm and trade embargoes on the U.S. and Israel. They can suspend the U.S. and Israel from the United Nations. So these are things that significant things that could be done. There's also something called the Doctrine of Universal Jurisdiction, which allows a country to try foreign nationals for atrocious crimes, even if it's not a direct relationship to their country. So there are other nations that could prosecute the U.S. and Israeli leaders for war crimes of targeting civilians. And then we have to remember that according to the U.S. law, this war is a violation. It violates the War Powers Resolution. Now, Congress did vote last week on another War Powers Resolution to try to stop this war, but it failed. And notably, there were four Democrats who voted against it, which was enough to kill it. We know how things work in Congress. You know, both the Democrats and Republicans are pro-war, and they generally are able to get just enough votes to pass something. And so folks that it would might hurt them to appear pro-war will vote for it, and then they can rustle up enough people to vote against it to stop this. Now, Middle East Eye had a really interesting article by Sumaya Ghanoushi, saying that the attack on Iran may be the U.S. Empire's Suez Canal moment. Empires end when they overreach, when they're at the height of their confidence and they believe that they can do anything. And the Suez moment revealed the limits of British power, and that the financial pressure mounted, international opposition mounted, and this whole empire then started to dissolve as a result of that. Now, March 13th is Al-Quds Day, and there's going to be a protest organized nationwide in the United States. And so they're calling for people to come out to the streets and incorporate solidarity with Iran, protest the imperialist Zionist war on Palestine. And they say, make anti-imperialist connections between the wars on Palestine, Iran, Cuba, Venezuela, Sudan, Lebanon, and Yemen, as well as domestic repression and ICE kidnappings. If you want to get information about that, find a protest near you, or you can also organize a protest. Go to the United National Anti-War Coalition website. It's unacpeace.org. And then in the European Union, there's within the left members of the EU Parliament, there is opposition to the war on Iran. There's a growing call to exit NATO and build a region that's focused on peace and respect for international law and to sever ties with the United States. And then in Germany, there was a huge protest last Thursday. 50,000 teenagers left school and went out to protest. And that was because of the conscription rules in Germany. On January 1st, the German military began sending out questionnaires to people who turn 18 this year. They're required to fill out the form. It's voluntary for women, but men have to fill that out. And then they may have to submit a physical exam. And this is a what they're calling a soft launch for a draft. And there's a lot of popular opinion against that in Germany. There was more I wanted to talk about, but I think I will have to stop there. We'll take a short musical break and come back with the interview with Beth Gilia.
1929. The financial house of cards collapses, and the overinflated stock market plunges into a Great Depression.
I got a sign on my door says 21 days to move. I got 21 bills say payment overdue. I got $21 to my name, 21 reasons to go insane. Now tell me, what am I gonna do? Oh, tell me, what am I gonna do? I'm gonna steal like a billionaire, stuff my pockets with them golden shares. Walk around in a pinstripe suit, I get away with all that loot. Never have to worry about paying my rent, I get a job with the president. Oh yeah, this time I get my share, I'm gonna steal like a billionaire.
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, speaking truth to expose the forces of greed with Margaret Flowers. And now I turn to my guest, Beth Gilia. Beth is an anthropologist and documentarian focused on urban political economy, land politics, and tech futurist territorial movements. She holds a PhD from American University and is based in Washington, D.C. and Barcelona, Spain. Beth, thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Beth, I first learned about your work, gosh, I think back when we were fighting corporate trade agreements in Washington, D.C., and you were at American University. You were studying what was going on in Honduras with the development of these economic free zones called, I guess, ZEDs or ZEDE. Can you first tell the listeners a little bit about what those are?
Sure. I think to understand what's really being talked about in Greenland today, in Gaza, in Venezuela, and even in the US, you have to start by understanding recent history in Honduras. So in 2009, there was a military coup in Honduras, as many people know. And it was at this point, you know, there was a really strong sort of wave of neoliberal reforms executed by the post-coup government. And that's when there was sort of a global libertarian network that started to think of Honduras as a place where they could carry out their sort of long-held dreams of creating libertarian territories by using, you know, the special economic zone model or special jurisdiction model to kind of create deregulated, privatized territories that could be basically sovereign. And this is something that libertarians have been experimenting with in very small niche projects since the 1950s. And then the movement sort of had a resurgence in 2008. And 2008 is when you see organizations like the Seasteading Institute, which was co-founded by Peter Thiel, we all know, you know, through Palantir, and Patrick Friedman, who's Milton Friedman's grandson. You know, they create the Seasteading Institute, and they sort of keep alive this dream of colonizing the ocean and creating libertarian free market jurisdictions on the ocean. So when the coup happens in Honduras, you have a radical right-wing government. They start to imagine doing this in Honduras and doing it on land. So at around the same time, you have Paul Romer, a Nobel Prize-winning economist from the U.S., repopularizing the idea of charter cities, which sort of fits in with this whole model of a private city, of a for-profit, investment-driven city. And so in 2013, the Honduran Congress passes the law for, as you've noted, ZEDES, which are economic development and employment zones. They had a few different names before that, but essentially a type of a charter city model in Honduras. And the project was really stagnant for, around a decade. The government had trouble securing investment. There was a lot of conflict, obviously, around this project. Honduran organizations considered it neocolonialism. It was challenged in the Supreme Court. It was declared unconstitutional even, and then it was sort of pushed through by the Juan Orlando Hernandez Congress. And it wasn't until really the start of the pandemic that you see the first private cities in Honduras launched. And the most widely known and the first of these is, of course, the Prospera Sede on the island of Roatan. And this is really sort of the flagship project of this sort of growing libertarian movement for private jurisdictions. And it has evolved since then into something called the Network State Movement. And what the Network State Movement wants to do is essentially organize investors and potential residents on the internet through DAOs, digital autonomous organizations, to allow investors who seek the same reforms, who want the same things, to pool their capital and then seek out territory. So it's inherently a settler colonial project. Seek out territory in different places throughout the world where they can have some kind of special jurisdiction that gives them certain amounts of autonomy, and to sort of get closer and closer to forming, sovereign nations or private nations. So that's where you see, organizations like Praxis starting to appear, which is the private, the network state organization. They call themselves a network empire that has been talking about settling in Greenland since the Trump administration started. That's, you also have projects like Crypto City popping up in Venezuela that are kind of a different iteration of the network state, but still part of the same project, creating sort of elite luxury real estate developments for foreigners to come settle on. In the case of Crypto City in Venezuela, it's mostly German immigrants that are being targeted to create these special jurisdictions that can allow for capital accumulation, basically through deregulation.
Right. So these are private zones where the laws of the country in which they reside, my understanding is, don't apply to these zones. They can make their own regulations. They can loosen the regulations, protecting workers, protecting the environment. Is that accurate?
Yes. So there are different degrees. With the case of the Zetes in Honduras, this is kind of the most radical version of this project. So Honduras had to reform its constitution in order to make these possible. And before they passed the Zede law in 2013, and it basically gives the Prospera government, for example, or other Zede governments, the ability to create their own judicial systems, their own security forces, their own rules and regulations, their own tax collection. They get to decide who can become, a quote unquote citizen or resident of the territory. So it's a really, really high level of autonomy. And then in other places like Crypto City in Venezuela, for example, you have these groups of investors that are sort of using a more universal, special economic zone model that already exists that is not as radical, but it does give them, for example, 5 years of tax-free status and other sort of, ability to fast track contracts and approvals and this kind of thing. So the intention is to take advantage of those conditions and create a settlement. And in the case of Praxis, it's kind of unclear. And some of, that I think is unknown, and that will depend on Trump's policies. So Trump has developed a policy for what was originally being called Freedom Cities in the U.S., and they've changed the name to acceleration zones, but it is still unclear exactly what kind of legal regime those zones will have under the Trump government.
Right. So I understand there are kind of some of these carve-out zones already in existence in the United States. I remember reading a long time ago about one that was in like the Midwest that was like a trade area, or maybe one that was in the Southwest as well. Do you know of any of these in the U.S. or any forms of them?
Yeah, so there are many different kinds of special economic zones in the U.S. And I think actually every single state in the U.S. has some kind of special economic zone. Mm-hmm. And so this is I think what's important about understanding this movement is that they're using what is kind of a, you know, fundamental tenet of the neoliberal era, which is this special economic zone where there are certain tax exemptions and so forth. And they're really sort of harnessing that to really fracture the nation state in a much more significant way. So the Freedom Cities Project in the US, it was actually sort of launched in part by Prospera and the Prospera Network, which is active in Honduras. And, you know, they were sort of able to capture the support of Trump during his campaign. And then, of course, now the Trump administration is closely allied with tech and crypto interests. So it's, you know, if Honduras is sort of the warning of what can happen when, you know, we sort of allow for this model to be taken to its extreme. And part of what the movement does is to really use the discourse of special economic zones in order to sort of hide the very extreme and radical nature of the project.
Right. So what kind of impact did these have on the population in Honduras?
So the ZEDES have been sort of one of the biggest threats to Honduran democracy and Honduran sovereignty presented in recent history. And I think, you know, Honduran social movements have resisted the ZEDES for that reason. In the most recent government, the Congress actually overturned the law in 2022, and the zones were declared unconstitutional again in 2024. So I think it's important to say that despite being declared illegal and unconstitutional, companies like Prospera have continued to operate under the ZEDE regime. And there is even an international arbitration case brought through CAFTA in ICSID, which is the investor state dispute settlement mechanism, claiming against the Honduran government up to, I think it's somewhere around $10.7 billion for threats to their, you know, supposed threats to their investment. So there's this really important legal battle taking place that has deep implications for sovereignty, obviously not just for Honduras, but for the whole world at this point, because it's sort of an example that they're, you know, seeking to replicate. And it's really a test to see how much can these private jurisdictions stand up to state sovereignty. So I think that's one of the biggest implications that really needs to be talked about. And then locally, of course, this is a land, like land hungry projects. This is about buying up land. You know, there are mechanisms that haven't been used yet in Honduras, but for direct expropriation of land. And so there are big threats to local communities in terms of land accumulation. Local communities in Honduras have sort of been trying to combat that loss of, you know, local water sources and other environmental impacts from real estate development happening in areas where it's not supposed to, or there are certain restrictions placed on it. But these zones are not following, again, Honduran environmental laws, labor laws. They're granting their own permits, environmental permits for their own development. And they're really sort of not beholden to Honduran laws or Honduran oversight. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So for the listeners, just, you know, the free trade agreements, so-called free trade agreements or corporate agreements, have these investor state dispute settlement entities that allow corporations to sue governments if their regulations in any way interfere with the profits of those corporations. And then these so-called arbitration courts are staffed by corporate lawyers that are frequently on leave from their job. They make a ruling that sets a precedent in favor of the corporations, and then that can be used in future cases. So this is really something that could, as you said, have ripple effects that are pretty severe. Is there anything you want to add to that, or is that pretty accurate?
Absolutely. No, I think you summarized it really well, sort of the use of ICSID and these investor state disputes to really sort of impose the will of investors on nation states. And I think one of the things that's precedent setting about the Prospera arbitration case is that they're claiming sort of an indirect expropriation of their investment and so forth. But what they're more so than defending their investment, they're really defending their legal rights and their legal autonomy in Honduran territory. And so what they're defending their right to operate under their own rules and to have their own government. And so that hasn't really been done within the ICSID system before. And I think it's important to understand that that's what's happening. This is not just another, you know, dispute over investment. This is really about who gets to make the rules.
Right. Yeah, that's scary. Now, in your article, U.S. Attacks in Venezuela, Greenland Lay Groundwork for Billionaire Fiefdoms, you wrote about in Southern California, in I think the San Diego area, there's been a proposal to create one of these zones, but connect it with a military base there. Can you explain to the listeners what that's all about?
Yeah, so a few months ago, Praxis, which again claims to have 150,000 members, over $1 trillion in total value of Praxian-founded companies, really heavily backed by large tech. One of the first projects that they proposed is Atlas, which would be sort of located in tandem with the Vandenberg Space Force Base, close to Santa Barbara.
Okay.
And this would be, you know, a private Praxian run jurisdiction focused on AI and military tech development and space exploration. And their idea is that it would sort of attract elite engineering talent by creating, you know, incentives and luxury beachside real estate developments and so forth, and use the DoD assets that are already on the military base to sort of, again, fast track testing and fast track the development and the marketing of new technologies.
Yeah. And I think that's really ominous considering, you know, we just had this whole thing with the, well, it's still kind of ongoing with the Pentagon, had a contract with Anthropic, which is an AI corporation that was trying to push, my understanding, push Anthropic to loosen the regulations or their positions on using this AI technology for weapons and mass surveillance. And there's a little bit of a battle going on there. So having artificial intelligence more deeply integrated into our military just sounds pretty dystopian to me.
And two of the early backers of Praxis are Peter Thiel's Pronomas Capital,
yeah,
and Joe Lonsdale, who's a co-founder of Palantir, together with Peter Thiel, is an early investor as well.
Right. So the kinds of things they would be doing would be, what do you anticipate if this were to happen?
I don't know. the technology side, exactly what they're planning on advancing and so forth is unclear to me. But I think you're right. Like, looking at the sort of dangers of what just happened with Anthropic and OpenAI, and, you know, really integrating AI into the military is really dangerous.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why I wrote the article was because there was a lot of talk about Praxis's ambitions to create a jurisdiction and to settle, or in their words, to create a Praxis nation in Greenland, when Trump was really ramping up his talks of potentially invading Greenland militarily and taking it over. And then obviously that has sort of calmed down a bit. And, you know, now the Trump administration is claiming that they're working on an agreement to give the US more sovereign military bases in Greenland. And I think that sort of talk about how Praxis and the private city movement ties into that has sort of subsided. And I think that because of this, you know, this desire to sort of create these military base private cities, I think it's still very much on the table, even in that kind of an agreement.
Yeah. So you wrote in the article about they wanted to kind of make Greenland the first kind of state, or quote unquote state, this private state.
So a lot of network state organizations are sort of constantly speculating on where their first settlement is going to be. And Praxis, for a while, you know, since 2023, was saying that the first Praxis nation was going to be somewhere in the Mediterranean. And then Trump's second term started. And Trump, you know, started talking about taking control of Greenland. And that's when they started talking about having the first, you know, Praxian settlement in Greenland. And then they proposed Atlas. So it's it's not entirely clear. I haven't seen any official documents, for example, about the Atlas project having any kind of special jurisdiction status. But given the amount of venture capital backing that these organizations have, I think it's important to just really to take these possibilities very seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting what they named it Atlas after the Ayn Rand book.
Exactly.
It's very, very much like a very libertarian, anti-regulation type of,
yes,
of approach. And one type of zone that we're seeing, so I was reading recently about how in the United Kingdom, since they had the Brexit and left the European Union, they're no longer bound by many of the regulations and laws of the European Union. They've had kind of an explosion of different types of these kinds of private zones. And one is an AI growth zone where an entity can purchase the land on debt, get the government to put in like data center infrastructure, and then they can have corporations use that and make money off of it and use that money to pay off their debt. So it's like a free state subsidized way to make money, which is not unheard of. But is that something I'm wondering, do you have a familiarity with that in other places? And like, is that something we should be kind of worried about in the United States with the explosion of AI data centers here under the Trump administration?
That's a great question. Yeah, I think, I think part of what is sort of justifying this race towards, you know, deregulating tech and so forth is this idea that we are in an artificial intelligence arms race, essentially, against China.
Mm-hmm.
And China has had AI development zones for a while. And I'm not too familiar with the nitty gritty of what those look like, legally speaking, or what sort, how they're subsidized and so forth. But I do think that is, it's sort of one of the, certainly one of the sort of most public discourses around why we need, for example, acceleration zones in the US, that part of this is about accelerating tech advancements and tech development, and that this is important, you know, supposedly for national security. So I think that we will continue to see it sort of being used as a justification for further deregulation and, you know, pushing these kinds of special jurisdictions.
Yeah. Yeah. The data centers in the US are, there's a lot of secrecy around them. Communities are not made aware of them. There's, you know, it's very concerning. Then you have that hand in hand with the build out of detention infrastructure. And so you have these corporate zones, which will take away our rights. And then you have infrastructure to detain people who perhaps might not be in favor of those types of things. It's a foreboding future.
Right.
And I wanted to get your thoughts on, because obviously, as you said, President Trump is very much in favor of these and, you know, working with these entities. He recently created the Board of Peace, which is kind of a private entity under his control. And, you know, he and his people put forward this proposal, I think, at the World Economic Forum in Davos last December to really turn Gaza into this like Mediterranean resort, private resort area. And I understand also that the Board of Peace is using cryptocurrency. Do you have a concern about that as an entity to accelerate this movement?
Yes, absolutely. So I think the plan that the Board of Peace is rolling out in Gaza really kind of mirrors the model of the private city. So you have the territory now under control of an unaccountable entity, the Board of Peace, but also run through a for-profit trust with the idea that, you know, governments and private investors that who invest in the trust can get a large return on their investment, essentially turning Gaza into a for-profit territory. And that really is the essence of this sort of private city, private jurisdiction model. And one of the things that is so dangerous about the Board of Peace is that they're no longer just focusing on Gaza, but sort of claiming that they have a mandate to operate, you know, across the world. And that this could become the new model for post-war reconstruction, which is essentially pillaging. And as you said, you know, part of the plan in Gaza is to have a, you know, a data center zone specifically dedicated to the interests of US tech companies.
Right. And I understand the U.S. is looking at building a military base in Gaza. So it all goes hand in hand. And of course, Trump has declared that he's going to be the leader of this Board of Peace, going forward. And a lot of concerns that it's going to kind of supplant the United Nations.
Yeah.
Really scary. So how can people... I'm so glad that you do this work. I wouldn't have known about it without the work that you're doing. But I don't hear a lot of discussion of this, and it feels like it's a very kind of an insidious type of thing that, you know, it can kind of sneak into an area. Where do you recommend that people can go to learn more about these types of free zones? Basically, I hate to call it a free zone, but corporate zones.
That's a great question. And I wish I had a better, more consolidated answer for it. Certainly for, the case of Honduras, which again is an ongoing legal battle, and there's ongoing social movement resistance. Following Honduras Solidarity Network for those updates is a really good place to go. And then globally, I think staying on top of the news and really listening. I think like when we read the media, it's important to, my sort of alarm bells always go off when I hear the term special economic zone and, oh, how there's going to be special economic zones in Gaza. And to me, that immediately tips me off that, that something deeper could be happening. And the same with Greenland as well. And just to be aware of, terms like freedom cities, acceleration zones in the US and what they really mean when we're looking at the media.
Right. And can you give the listeners a little bit of an idea of how folks in Honduras, like what types of things were they doing to fight back against the zones there?
So initially there was a lot of legal pushback. There were a lot of claims of inconstitutionality filed in the Supreme Court. Like I said, in 2012, there was a ruling of inconstitutionality by the Supreme Court, and then the Constitutional Chamber of the Supreme Court was sort of overthrown and replaced, and the law was passed again under a different name. And during that whole time, there were organizations like OFRANE, which is the Black Fraternal Organization of Honduras, that staged an ongoing protest outside of the Supreme Court over a long period of time. And then, in 2020, when it was made known to the public that there were three ZEDEs that had actually been approved and signed, the charters had been signed in secret without any public input whatsoever, there really was, national movement reignited, and people were using local governments, the municipal governments, to hold, consultas, basically public forums where they were voting against ZEDEs in that municipality. And one of the dangerous things that the ZEDE law did when it was still on the books in Honduras was completely take all the power away from municipal government. So this was something that was imposed. Basically, territory was taken away from municipal jurisdictions against the will of the people and the municipal government. So you start to see this really local resistance in which people were declaring their municipalities free of ZEDEs. And I think that's going to be really important on a global scale as well. And then, unfortunately, the recent Honduran elections, we have the right-wing National Party back in power in Honduras. And we have Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was the biggest promoter of the ZEDEs, now released from prison, pardoned by President Trump. And so there is concern. And because, ZEDEs like Prospera have sort of been waiting this out and waiting to see what the next government would look like, and if they could re-legislate and make the ZEDEs legal again. There's a lot of concern in Honduras that this will sort of spark another wave of ZEDE development if they are able to do that. It's unclear at this point, but I think there will continue to be grassroots resistance.
Yeah, no, that's scary. And then also with the recent election in Costa Rica for that, more neoliberal government, right-wing government there. It's concerning for that region. Beth, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with me today.
Thank you. Thank you for the interview.
You've been listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed. I'm Margaret Flowers. My guest today was Dr. Beth Gelia, I'll go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want.
We'll lift our brothers and our sisters. We'll lift the people together, can overthrow the system.